Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm rebroadcasting an interview I did last year with Mary Testa, who was here in Sarasota, Florida, then part of the ensemble company of the production of Love, Loss, and What I Wore at the Oslo Repertory Theater. Currently, Mary is back, starring in a one-woman tour de force called My Brilliant Divorce. So after I play the interview that I did last year, in which you will hear how Mary became who she is, which is quite extraordinary, that is, that she is quite extraordinary, then I'm going to follow it up with an interview in which she talks about her current production, My Brilliant Divorce. So hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can.
Is all about you and me and all of us and the ways in which we may be hiding parts of ourselves, the ways in which we may have learned as children that some things about us didn't get the response, the reaction that we wanted them to get. And so cleverly, and we are so clever as children, we begin to hide those ways of being that didn't work, that brought a reaction or a consequence that we didn't like. And it can be anything from, a frown to neglect to punishment to trauma. In any case, we get the idea that this thing that we did or this way that we were, it didn't get us what we wanted. It got us something we didn't want. And we become able to first pretend and then to hide whatever it was. And over time, because we're so good at hiding, we actually forget that we have that quality, that ability, that way of being. The problem with this is that while that almost certainly worked to our benefit as children, that is, we didn't do the thing that brought down the consequence we didn't want, later in life, that quality, that aspect, that way of being may very well be something that we need. something that our life could benefit from, something that it would make it possible for us to live the life we were really meant to live. And so the Lynn Show is really all about talking about this fact, bringing awareness to this fact. Is there something that you may have hidden, you may have forgotten that you have? Maybe you even yearn for it. Maybe you even wonder if maybe it's in there. So the Lynn Show is about making this point, bringing it up into the light, so to speak, because we are so good at keeping it. The word I use for it is that we keep it undercover, and that what we demonstrate, what we show the world, the way we really think about ourselves, is actually a cover story. It's the truth, but it's not the whole truth, because some of the truth we're hiding undercover. And it is possible to resurrect some of those things that we have kept undercover. But it isn't as easy as recognizing it, saying it, and saying, you know, Shazam, there it is. It is a kind of work, and I know about this because I'm a psychotherapist, and it's the work I do all the time. And so I also want to say, if you are curious about discovering, uncovering, recovering something that you may have hidden, you might want to think about psychotherapy. You can think about it with me or someone else, but you might want to think about it. And if you're thinking about it with me, I do all my work these days on the telephone. So you can reach me by going to my website, thelynnshow.com, thelynnshow. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. You get a different The Lynn Show. thelynnshow.com. And on that website, you can find a button to click that's email me, and if you email me, I will respond. You can also get a copy of my book, When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. You can read an article about therapy on the phone called Psychotherapy on the Go. And you can listen to all of the interviews that I've done, all of the shows that I've done, and up to and including the one you're going to hear today. And as I said, this interview is with the really amazing Mary Testa. If you have seen Mary on stage, you know what I'm talking about. And in this first part of the interview, Mary talks about how she became who she is. And she demonstrates in the way that all the people I interview, and I only interview people who make their living or their life with an art, that there is a congruence to these people, that they are who they really are. And at the same time that Mary is demonstrating that, she's also demonstrating what I was talking about a little while ago, about keeping qualities undercover. Listen to her talk about how becoming who she is, while it works so well for her, also has cost her in the capacity to trust. So it might be that for Mary, the ability to trust is one of the things that she has undercover. Anyway, this is a very interesting, forthright, open, honest, and for me, compelling interview. And then listen to her talk about her current work, which is My Brilliant Divorce, which she is performing, she, and only she, at the Oslo Repertory Theater in Sarasota, Florida. You will hear me say that I saw it and it's brilliant and encourage you to come on down. But now, listen to Mary Testa talk about herself, her life, and her work, and then hear what she says about My Brilliant Divorce.
That is correct. Oh, thank you very much.
There you go.
I am here with the technologically savvy.
Not really. I do know how to press record.
I got it, Mary Testa. So I interview people who make their living or their life with an art.
Right.
And it's quite clear what you make, the art with which you make your life and your living.
Oh, thank you, yes.
It's right. And it's acting and theater? Okay, good.
Oh, I sing as well, so I do a lot of concert work. I do everything. I do theater, television, movies, concert work, web series, all kinds of things.
You're a performer?
Yes.
Yes.
I'm an artist.
And you're an artist in the best sense of the word.
Yes.
Great. Okay, so I ask one question.
Okay.
And it is, How did it start? Which is to say, not your first job, but when was the first moment in your childhood that it occurred to you, or someone said to you, or you had an experience that suggested that performing, that singing, that dancing, that entertaining, that having an influence, any of that would be something you would want to do? Do you know?
I think it wasn't a tangible thing for me, but I know that the story, the classic stories, family stories, was that I used to, when I was like two, do somersaults for the company. You know, so the entertainment aspect
right.
was instilled in me not early. And I've always enjoyed being sort of boisterous and saying things that everybody's thinking but won't say.
Yeah.
So I think that kind of attention sort of got into my bones.
Well, so, you know, so it's let me entertain you at a very young age?
I guess, but it's more like being bold.
Yes, I see it. And making, having an impact.
Yeah.
Right? Or causing a reaction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think my own brand of it is also making everybody comfortable at the same time while doing it. Not alienating people,
yes.
but making people feel drawn in by it, by my audacity.
Yeah. You know? Sort of creating the environment in which other people can too.
Yeah.
Am I making that right?
Yeah, I think that makes sense. So I think I felt that as an early, in my early
okay,
ages.
So of course, what I want to know is, where would that have come from? Not everybody feels that.
I think it came from being, I did it when I was a little kid, and I'm not quite sure where it came from. I mean, my parents were outgoing, nice people and fun people.
Well, they certainly, one of the things, well, there are a number of ways this can happen, but, and I really want to know where its, you know, etiology is, where it stems from, but once you've done it, if you don't get, don't do that, Mary.
Yeah.
You know, if
yeah.
you get, you know, you didn't get that, you must have gotten.
I think I got, you know, don't show off or things like that, but I don't think it stopped me. And I also, I think a large part of it, of my detriment and my wonderfulness.
Asset. Right, right.
Is that I went to Catholic school and was pretty beat up on by the nuns. And so, not physically, but mentally.
No, no, no.
And so I think that I made a definite, I wanted to be my own person, and they want you to be what, you know, everything
yeah, yeah, yeah.
that you're not. And I think I, in order to defy them, I became even more.
Okay, so, but you know that everybody does not respond to that kind of squashing.
Right.
With, I'll show you.
Yeah.
Everybody doesn't do that, so... Did you have siblings?
I had a sister. I still have an older sister, 4 years older. Very different from me. She's very funny in her own way, but she's not as outgoing. Well, that's not really true, but then, when
right,
we were children,
right.
I was the more
you were the one.
Outgoing one.
You
yes.
were the one,
yeah.
right. And, it's fascinating because it clearly, it either came with the genes or something very early caused you to believe that you could do that, you should do that,
mm-hmm.
and more than that, that it became something that defined you?
Yeah, I think that's very true. I think that's really true, you know. My personality took first place over my looks, because I was everything I wasn't supposed to be. You know,
yeah.
when I was in Catholic school, my nuns were all Irish. I was an Italian girl. I was one of a few Italian kids in my class. They despised me for that. So they were awful. I mean, I have so many friends who went to Catholic school, and the stories are just legendary. But, you know, so I had curly hair at a time when straight hair was the thing to have. I had boobs when nobody had boobs. I had glasses. You know, I had everything you weren't supposed to have. So instead of letting that defeat me,
yeah.
I just said, well, nobody's going to notice me physically because nobody paid attention to me physically. Nobody said, oh, what a pretty little girl you are. I had a personality that was larger than the room.
Right.
So I think that's, you know,
yeah.
that's what it was.
Well, it became clear early on that that was your ticket. That was
your,
that was the currency that that was going to get you through life.
Yeah, right? I guess it's true. And I thought, you know, I'm not going to sit looking at a microscope. You know, I'm going to go out where there's entertainment
to be had. Okay. So, when did you start Catholic school? How old were you when you?
I was seven. And I went slammed right into Catholic school because I did not go to preschool or any kindergarten or anything.
This is your first school experience.
I slammed right into just awful, you know, horrible. My parents, to their credit, were really under the assumption, and possibly partly true, that it was a better education. Mm-hmm. The Catholic school was a better education. And, you know, I was a straight-A student, with the exception of conduct. I always got D's. Straight A, and then D for conduct, always. Yeah.
That must have pissed them off, too, that you got straight A's.
Yes, it did,
right.
Because they couldn't relegate me. And there were plenty of kids in my class who were not so bright and were troublesome, so that they could really just be mean to them and slap them around and do things to them, and the kids had no recourse. I had a brain that was always working overtime that was like, I'll get you better, you know, kind of. Which is what I did. But, you know, it's detrimental to me, too, because it caused a lot of problems for me, you know, that I'm realizing in adult life,
yes.
You know, of trust issues and things like that, of trusting someone to help me out. I always thought I had nobody who had my back, so. Maudlin, but, you know.
No, I don't. I think it's not. I think, and actually it's important because it must have helped to form who you are and how you got where you got and what you did.
I think so.
But as I think you're beginning to point out, is that it's a double-edged sword.
Absolutely.
You know, on the one hand, you can do anything and you will do everything and nobody will stop you. And on the other hand, you have to do everything.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Yeah. Catholic school from the time you're seven to?
When I graduated eighth grade. And then I got accepted into a Catholic high school that was very exclusive in Newport, Rhode Island, with five kids in each class.
Wow.
And I said to my parents, no way.
Wow.
I'm done. I'm done going to church, too. And they were like, do, you know, whatever you want to do. They were, you know, because we had to go to church like three times a week when you're in Catholic school, and every Sunday you're supposed to go to church. So I was like, I'm done with this whole thing.
Wow.
And so I
they
then
didn't
went to,
know when they sent you off to school that they were.
They had no idea until about the sixth grade, because I would come home every day and tell them.
Oh. Okay, so So
I went to a public high school, but the bad thing about that was I didn't know anybody.
Yes, of course.
So I went to a high school where they all grew up together.
Of course.
And I knew nobody. So that was tough, too. So I really wasn't comfortable in school until college.
Wow.
Mm.
So you compensated for that, for all of the things that they did to you that made it difficult for you. You compensated for it by being bigger and bigger and bolder and smarter
kind of.
And smarter.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, it's interesting because on the one hand, it's just a gift. You could do it. Not everyone, as you pointed out, could have done it. Not everybody was smart enough. Not everyone had the talent. No, not everyone had the chutzpah.
Right.
You know, to do it. So you had it, but it must have been lonely in its way.
Yeah, there's moments. Yeah. Yeah, totally.
I think school is tough for a lot of kids for a lot of reasons.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Okay, but so did you do any singing, dancing, entertaining in any of this?
My mother sang, and so I always sang with her when I was a kid. So I had a natural voice. And I sang, I have a classic story. We lived right across the street from a golf course, and one day, I think I was about nine, my mother had gone to the store. She said, I'll be right back. So I was in the house singing at the top of my lungs, and we were right across in the second tee off, and the second hole. And I sang this big number, big finish, and I heard applause. And I looked out the window, and there were like 20 men who were like, what? And I was so mortified. I sat under the window, pulled the shade down, sat under the window until my mother got home. But so I realized, that I kind of have a power. So my high school had my grammar school and my high school had absolutely no artistic anything in it.
Oi.
But I started sort of doing stuff after high school and in college. That's when I pursued.
Well, that's pretty amazing. I mean, that you started with the somersaults at 2, you knew that you could sing by 9, that you didn't get an opportunity. Did you think about that at all? Did you daydream that? Nothing?
No.
Did you have any thoughts at all about what you were going to do when you got out of this? You were just doing 1 foot over in front of the other.
Yeah, just 1 foot in front of the other, and I've kind of always been that way. High school is when I went, what do I want to do with myself? And one day I just went, should I be a lawyer or should I be an actor? And I went, I think I'll be an actor because I don't have to go to school as long. That was literally the day. That was the decision.
I believe you.
And then I just followed that path. And I do that. My boyfriend always says to me, don't you have a plan? And I go, no, I don't think that way.
You don't need to.
I never have. I am really like a pinball machine. I'm like a pinball. I go, and whatever I hit up against, I do.
Yeah.
And I don't plan, like, okay, next year I want to do this, and next year I want to do that, and then I want to have this by this time, and I want to have that. I don't think that way. I never have.
No, and it's worked for you.
I suppose, and I suppose it's double-edged as well. Like, maybe if I had a plan, things would be different. I don't know. But that's just not the way I think, so.
It's an interesting question. I tend to believe that your way of doing it makes much more sense. With the possible exception of if someone has a plan, they are flexible.
Right.
But generally speaking, when people have plans, they have it in stone. And so when they rub up against something that they could have, they don't go there.
Yeah, that's true.
You know?
Inspiration. You miss inspiration.
You miss everything.
But I think that the bad thing about not having a plan is that you don't... Like, I don't know if I know how to dream big.
Wow.
You know what I mean?
Yes, I do.
Because I don't think of the biggest thing that can happen. I have just 1 foot in the next thing. So I think that's the detriment to not having a plan. Because if you have a plan, you can dream real big.
Okay, so having said that, I know that it's not who you are and it's not how you've ever acted and all that stuff, but could you, having said... I think that there's an advantage to having to dreaming big.
Mm-hmm.
Could you ask yourself to dream big?
I occasionally do, and it makes me a little bit uncomfortable.
Anxious. I'll bet it does.
I don't quite know how to...
What to do with it.
What to do with it.
Yeah.
Interesting. I never really thought about this. This is an interesting conversation because I never really put all this
stuff... You never took it further.
No.
Yeah. But it makes... It makes perfect sense, your inability to what you're calling dream big, given all that stuff that happened to you in your childhood. I mean, you were literally having to deal with what was in front of you every minute.
Yeah.
You couldn't afford to take your eye off the ball because you were going to get hurt all over the place.
Yeah, pretty much.
You know?
I was going to be humiliated
or, embarrassed, neglected.
Exactly.
Right,
exactly.
All that shit, mm-hmm. which, you know, I mean, so you created an M.O., that focused on what was in front of you, and that's very efficient, actually.
Yeah.
You know? So, you don't have to answer this.
Okay.
Of course, you don't have to answer anything I ask you.
Yeah.
And I'm not offended. I don't care.
Okay.
So, however, having made that caveat, do you have any awareness? This is, I'm guessing, that when you think about the big plan, the giant dream, the, you know, what if thing, that you get a little uncomfortable or anxious? That's what it seemed like you were saying. Was
yeah.
that accurate?
Yeah.
Okay. So, what are you willing to, just for the moment, ask yourself if you've got any idea what that anxiety is about?
Yeah, it's like a therapy session, this.
Well, you don't have to go there.
No, but
I'm
it's
curious.
Interesting.
So, but you don't have to, and I'll take all of this out.
No, you don't have to take it out. I'm perfectly comfortable with it. I just, it's like I haven't thought about that. I don't know. I think that would take me a little bit more than a minute to answer.
Okay, fine.
I need to think about that.
Yeah, well, fine. It's not required. I'm curious.
Yeah,
I'm curious.
Yeah.
Because... See, my own personal philosophical base is that it's, better is a very bad word, it's not the one I want, Results are more what one would want, ugh, to find a very uncomfortable phrase, if one can stay open to what the universe is offering at any moment, mm-hmm. to use your pinball analogy. I think that is the... If you can do that, then you have the best shot at actualizing everything that you can do. Because the universe will bring things that you might not have anticipated.
Right.
And if you bang into this thing, it may knock you into that thing, which couldn't have been in your grand plan because you didn't know that thing was there.
Exactly.
Right. So I think that however it occurred that you have this way of being, that it's the most efficient and the one that's mostly guaranteed to get you able to experience whatever you're able to experience, and that most people don't have that. Most people have that other thing.
Yeah, that makes sense.
The five-year plan.
Right, that makes sense.
You know, who do I want to be when, and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Having said all that, the ability to do both is nice. I suppose that's all I wanted to say about that.
Well, I think that's good. That makes sense, and that gives me something to think about, so thank you for that.
I thought
that's a very interesting thing, why it makes me so uncomfortable to dream big. All right, so great. It's very interesting.
Were you able to dream a little bigger or to dream big occasionally, that would not, it seems to me, make it not possible for you to continue to carom off whatever the universe offers.
Right.
You're not going to lose that. So.
Yeah, you're right about that. So why not dream a little bigger?
All right, enough. I'm sorry.
Okay, enough.
Sorry.
It's okay.
You have to stop me. You really have to stop me.
No, that's okay. That's good. That's good for me to think about. That's a very positive thing that came out of this.
Well, good. I'm glad. Okay, so high school, I don't know why. This interview just keep knocking me off into tangents, but did you ever hear Bill Clinton say that when he was, I think, in high school, he looked in the mirror and he said, let me see, saxophone player or politician?
Did he really?
He did.
See that?
He did. But what he said, which I thought was absolutely fascinating, he said, so I'm a really good saxophone player, but I will never be the best. But I can be the best politician.
Oh, there you go. Well,
and
good
he
for
was.
Him. And he sure, yeah, he sure was.
And he was, you know.
Yeah.
But I don't think very many people do that, really.
No.
You know.
I know, no.
You and Bill.
Because I think I would have made a kick-ass lawyer.
Of course you would have.
Yeah, but I'm happy doing this.
Good.
Because, you know, this is...
Well, then we're happy. Because so many more people get to experience you this way.
That's true.
You know, you're a gift. Don't
thank
you. Right.
That's very
okay.
Nice.
So high school, you say lawyer or actor, and you say actor, and then what?
Then after high school, I auditioned for a special school that was in Rhode Island at the time. I don't think they have it anymore. It's called Governor's School for the Young and Gifted in the Arts, and they had theater, art, dance. They had like a bunch of programs, and it was like a 3-month school, and it was always held in different places. And I was accepted into the theater program. And
just stop. No training, no learning, no classes.
No, I went to my high school guidance counselor, who was an old woman, Mrs. Oh, I can't remember her name now. And while she was out of the room, as a matter of fact, probably before this meeting, but I snooped through all my records so that I saw my IQ, I saw my aptitude test scores, I saw everything. My aptitude test scores, business-wise, I got 1%. Artistic, I was 99%. So I'm right back. So I said, what should I do? I have to audition for this. I don't know. I think I had to prepare Shakespeare. So she said, well, you have to do the Quality of Mercy speech from Merchant of Venice. Is that Merchant of Venice?
Yeah.
The Quality of Mercy. And so I was like, okay. So I just memorized the Quality of Mercy speech, and I auditioned for a wonderful actor. He's since passed away. His name was George Martin. He was going to be the teacher. He was a brilliant actor that worked a lot at Trinity Square Rep, which is a very respected regional theater in Rhode Island. And he also, over the years, worked in New York and did a lot of great work, film work, television work, all of that stuff. He saw me and apparently said, this girl's got talent. And he accepted me in the program. I don't know how good I was doing the Quality of Mercy speech, But he noticed something in me. And over the years, I would run into him, and he'd always remind me,
I always saw
looked
you.
At you. Right. That girl has
right, now. I knew it.
So I did this three weeks. I don't even remember how long it was, but it was on the Barrington College campus, and I did this program. And then I wanted to go to UCLA and go into their theater department. And my father said, no, you can't leave the state. So you pick a college in Rhode Island. So I went to the University of Rhode Island.
So we picked the smallest state in the union.
Well, that's where I live. That's where
I know, but...
But he wouldn't let me go out of the state. And, you know, it was fine.
Okay.
You know, I mean, I wonder what my life would be like if I had gone to UCLA. But I went to University of Rhode Island, who had a great theater program at the time when I was there. And I majored in theater, and I took every theater course I could by the time I finished my first semester junior year. I had everything that I wanted, and I said, I'm quitting, and I'm going to move to New York. And my parents were like, you need to finish so you can get a degree. And I said, I don't want a degree. I just want to go to New York. So that's what I did. I quit. I worked three jobs to save up enough money. I think I had $1,000, which to me I thought was so much money at the time. This was 1976. And at September 6th, 1976, I moved to New York. While I was in college, I met a writer named William Finn, who wrote March of the Falsettos, In Trousers, March of the Falsettos. He's won multiple Tonys. I met him while I was in college, and so when I moved to New York, I started singing with him, me and two other girls, and that's how we all started. His first show was called In Trousers, and I was in it. That's how I sort of started. So I kind of hit the ground running.
Yeah.
I worked for 3 years as a waitress and a cashier to pay the bills, and then I never had to work another waitressing job again.
Right, another day, another day gig.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
So that's, in a nutshell, that's how it all started.
And it was just what, I mean, it so fits you.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I had never lived anywhere but my parents' house. I mean, I moved out to go to college. I lived on campus at college, but I just moved to New York.
Right,
you know,
I know.
Was really, and I must have had guardian angels, because one of the first few months I was there, someone knocked on my door, and I looked through the peephole, and it was a man, and he said, I live above you, and my wife is very sick, and I need to take her to the hospital, but I don't have any money. Can you help me? And
I had
$20 on me. That's all I had. And I opened the door, and I gave it to him, and I said, I really do need the change back. And I never saw him again.
Of course not.
And as soon as I closed the door, I went, okay.
Yeah, right.
I get it.
Right.
Without being raped or murdered.
Right, right. You learned the lesson.
I get it.
Right.
So it was like, here's your lesson. You don't learn it now, you're going to learn it again.
Yeah, that's right.
So I learned it.
Right.
So then I sort of wised up.
Right.
But, I was green. I didn't know anything from the big city. So...
Well, the other thing that's sort of curious to me is your parents said you can't go out of the state, so you listened like a very good little girl.
I did.
But then when they said you have to finish college, you were no longer that good little girl. What the hell happened in those 2 years?
And I just knew what I wanted to do, and they sort of knew that I knew what I wanted to do. And but my dad was worried about it. My dad was not happy. It took him a few years to adjust to the fact that I was living. I mean, he instantly thought that I would, become a prostitute, I think. Not because he distrusted me, but because he distrusted
the city, right, and he figured
So it took him a while. My mom was always behind me because she was a thwarted singer.
Ah, yes.
So she had dreams of performing herself. So, she was always support. They've both always been very supportive, but my dad was a little leery.
Yeah, right. It's interesting, I mean, because your mother was a singer, but she didn't pursue it, or she married and had
children? Well, my mother was a singer, and this is a great story, too, and she and my aunt and a friend of theirs were a threesome, like the Andrews sisters. They were called the Gay Sisters, and they had made, at the time, you could go and make a record, and they made a bunch of records for boys, their brothers and boyfriends on the ships during the war, and they were good, and I actually have their recordings, and they auditioned. There was a great big talent search at the Biltmore Hotel in downtown Providence, which was a big deal, and they auditioned to win a big band contract for a year, and they won.
Wow.
And they went home and asked my grandfather, and my grandfather said
no.
So that was it.
Wow.
That was it.
So there was no chance that your mother was going to let your father stop you?
Probably not. Probably not. Although I don't think they had that conversation.
Yeah, even if they had.
Yeah, right. I don't think that was part of it, but yeah.
Right, right. So she never... So this is kind of interesting to me because she took what Grandpa said and she didn't go and they didn't, none of
them
did.
Well, you know, that was a different time.
No, no, I understand that. Yeah. I'm not criticizing her. I'm just saying that that wasn't an option for her.
No. No, so she got married and had kids. And
then she had one who, and she had, from the very beginning...
She had two very smart children, but one who wanted to be in show business.
And not only who wanted to be in show business, but who insisted from the very beginning on being who she was.
Yeah, kind of.
You know, there was no... Nobody could stop you.
No.
Nobody could hurt you bad enough to stop you.
No, I know. Well, that's true. They did, but, you know, that's for another conversation. But, yeah. You're right.
And here you are.
And here I am.
Right. And here you are.
Mm-hmm.
It's wonderful.
In Florida.
In Florida. Well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not so bad. Not so bad. I am the kind of person who doesn't like to go out of town and work. I generally don't.
No.
I generally stay in New York. But the funny thing is, I just recently won a Drama Desk Award for 3 decades of excellent work.
Oh,
and
my goodness.
And for a show I did that was written for me called Queen of the Mist. And I won this award on June 5th, and I have no work in New York.
No.
No work in New York. So this came up, which is
excellent.
And
you said,
phew, I have?
Right,
yeah,
right,
to work.
Right, right.
So, but this is very pleasant, and I had done it in New York, too. So.
Yeah. When you say this is very pleasant, do you mean doing the show or being here at the Oslo?
All of it. Yeah? It's very nice, very comfortable. They treat us very well.
Yeah,
they take great care of us. The apartments we're staying in are great. And I was able to bring my dog and car and I'm tool around. And, you know, it's beautiful here. So it's all great.
Okay. So the other question I ask is, having given a life to this work and... It's funny because it sounds like you started out giving a life to this work with the somersaults, and then we had a little hiatus here while you had to get old enough to get out of that thing, right? And then you have essentially given your life to this work.
I kind of have.
Yeah. Right. And so I just ask, is there anything you would say about that, about what it's like, about what you think about it, about how you feel about it, or anything at all?
Well, you know, I guess a lot of sacrifices were made. I'm not I so focused on work for so long. I never focused on, you know, children or marriage or anything like that. And I just focused on what my voice told me to do, kind of, you know. It's thrilling, and it's also hard.
Yes, it is hard.
So... I don't know what quite to say about it. I know my boyfriend and I have had discussions about it because he's, like, sometimes frustrated by the fact that he's like, you seem to just focus on your work, but I'm sort of used to doing that I do focus on my work. Not to the exclusion of him, but, you know, I do focus on my work, so.
Well, I really want you to go on because I want to hear everything you have to say about it, but I do want to say that all this focus on the work seems to have paid off. That's why you got the award. They didn't give it to you because you didn't pay attention to
it. Well, no, that's true.
Does it feel sweet to focus on the work? Do you know what I mean?
If the work is good, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've had a tremendously artistically fulfilling time lately.
So, of the things that you have done, what are the things that are your favorite?
A musical written for me by someone who I think is just brilliant. His name is Michael John Lacusa. I've worked on a lot of his shows, and I just think he is brilliant, and the world hasn't even caught up to him yet. And he wrote me a show, and it was my first lead. I sang everything and said everything, and it was a spectacularly beautiful experience.
Can you tell? Because I don't know about it.
It's a musical about a woman, Anna Edson Taylor, who at the age of 61... In the 1900s, went over Niagara Falls in a barrel of her own design and lived.
Oh, my goodness!
And did it to become famous and become rich, and neither of which happened.
And she was...
You're kidding. She did it at, with her big dream and that didn't happen?
She was a woman not of her time. And she became famous for a time, but because she was a woman and because she was not, you know, your classic standard of what they thought a woman should be at that time, pretty much ignored. And her feat, which everybody sort of made fun of, her brilliance was ignored. And she died a pauper, alone.
Oh, my God.
It's an amazing story, a true story. And this is what the musical is. And it's it was a tremendous thrill to be. Because I've always been a supporting person, you know. And to be the lead was phenomenal. And it was a very emotional, it's a very emotional piece. So it was a real, like, wrung out every night. But it was fantastic. So I'm known, you know, mostly for doing comedy. I do everything. And I have a, and this sounds so snotty, but it's really true, I have an enormous talent that has never been tapped into.
Yeah.
Just little pieces have been tapped into. So to get to do...
To you, Dad, yeah.
Mostly I get people who see the show and they're, you're so funny.
Yeah, right.
I say, but I made you cry. But I first made you cry, didn't I?
Yeah, right.
But I don't say that to people.
No.
But that's what I think. It's
right.
Like, but nobody says that. You know, nobody reacts to that, which is fine. You know, it's great to be funny. And it's, my, you know, I'm known for doing that.
And it's how you started.
Yeah.
It's the somersaults. People weren't crying.
That's true. It's true.
You know, you can always reverse to that. So is there any, are there any plans to do Queen of the Mist again?
I don't know. You know, the thing is, it's art. Nobody cares about art. Really, yeah.
No, I think that's right.
You know, so it was done beautifully. I don't know. I'm sure there, you know, Rodgers and Hammerstein office licenses Michael John's stuff. So now that we've done it, it's a great role for a woman in between 40s and 60s. And hopefully it will be done. You know, I'd love to do it again.
Right.
But I don't know that there are any plans to do it. Like, I'd love to do it in London. But I don't think that anything is happening like that. So I have no idea. Unless they're working behind the scenes, I don't know. I don't think...
Yeah, okay, all right. Okay, so I'm not going to ask you if there's anything you'd like to do.
Well, I want to do everything, and I like doing new stuff. I this is what I'd like to do. I'd like a series. I'd like a television series.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like, ideally, I would like a half-hour sitcom, because that's the easiest gig on the planet.
Right.
I could make money, I could have my weekends free,
right,
and I could have fun. And I would love that. And I keep putting that out there, and I hope that happens. But
and so do I.
Yes, thank you.
So if you're listening...
Universe.
Right, Mary's available.
And I'd like it shot in New York. That's a lot to ask, but, you know, it's possible.
Well, if you're asking, you might as well.
I may as well dream big.
Yeah, that's right. So, anything else to say about the... maybe being a woman in theater, or just being in theater itself?
Well, being a woman in theater is interesting. My boyfriend is always saying to me, you really should direct. I don't know that I have that capacity because I know how I would approach stuff, but I think a director has an overview, that has to have an overview.
Right.
And I'm not sure that that's where my brain goes. But I have moments when I see things and I go, God, I wish you did it this way, or I wish you did it that way. So... And I think that the theater needs more women directors. And there are great women directors, but they just don't get the same opportunities that men do. They just don't.
Not only everywhere.
Yeah, right. Everywhere. Right. Still. Mm-hmm. Everybody thinks we've moved so far, but we haven't.
No,
not at all.
We haven't.
We haven't at all, and it's actually become more...
Yes, I know.
Yeah.
It's what is the word when it goes backwards? It's reverting? Yeah, it's reverting.
It is.
It definitely is.
And it's become more sinister in a way.
I agree. Mm. And the more you stand out, the more you're at the mercy of the reversion. Boy, I didn't.
No, I get what you mean. Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah.
Makes sense, yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is wonderful. And you're a remarkable person.
Oh, isn't that nice of you to say?
No, I really...
You get that just from seeing the show?
No, I got it from talking to you.
Oh, thank you.
I think that you downplay to some extent what you had to overcome to be who you are and to give what you give.
You're making me cry.
Well, I think it's true. And
thanks.
So I want to thank you very much for this and for everything that you do on stage that gives us all this pleasure.
Thank you so much. That's very nice of you to say.
You're very, very welcome.
This is a very interesting interview because it made me think about stuff.
I didn't make you laugh. I made you cry.
It's all good.
So, there you have the exuberant, the delightful, the forthright, the in-your-face Mary Testa. And she's like that on stage. She's compelling. She's intriguing. You don't want her ever to leave the stage. You want her to go on and on and on. So now, listen to her talk about her performance in this extraordinary one-woman show, My Brilliant Divorce.
So I'm here with Mary Testa, who is in this tour de force performance of, what is her name?
Angela Kennedy Lipsky.
Yes, Angela Kennedy Lipsky, who is experiencing her My Brilliant Divorce at the Oslo Repertory Theater in Sarasota, Florida. And so I've asked Mary to talk about the play, how it happened, what you think about it, you know, pretty much anything you want to say about it.
Okay. Well, last year I was here doing Love, Loss, and What I Wore, and yes. Michael Edwards, the artistic director of the Oslo, called me one afternoon and while we were doing the run and said, there's something I want to talk to you about. And he said, I have this play, and I think you'd be great. And
so this goes all the way back to last year?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, wow.
So I said, well, I'd love to read it, and I read it, and I really liked it. It's really funny. It takes a very facile person to be able to do it, which I am, so I thought this is perfect for me.
Well, and it allows you to show so much of what you can do.
Right, yes.
You don't get to sing, but that's about all.
Yes, it's true. And so I read it, and I said, I'd love to do it. So he said, I want to do it the same time next year, same time slot. I said, that sounds great. Mm-hmm. So I've sort of known for a year. And Michael says that he was going, oh, great, you're going to get a Broadway show or something's going to happen. And he said that he wouldn't do the play. If I couldn't do it, he wasn't going to do it,
yeah.
Which is great. So it all worked out. And it's about a woman who goes through a divorce that happens to her unbeknownst to her. It's sort of a surprise. It was originally written for Dawn French, who is a brilliant actress, comedian. French and Saunders are a comedy group. Jennifer Saunders and Dawn French, they wrote Absolutely Fabulous, which is a television show that's hilarious. And so I thought, if it was written for Dawn French, I'm there, because I'm a big fan. And it was originally written as a British woman. It was all taking place in London. The writer, Geraldine Aaron, changed it for us.
Really?
To make her an American woman who's married to a Brit, yes. So anyway, it's about a woman who goes through a three-year process of divorcing a husband that she has been with 20-plus years, finding herself, and having a brilliant ending. And I just think it is the kind of piece that everybody can relate to in one way or another,
yes.
And that everybody sees themselves in one way or another, and even men. And it's wonderful to do, and great fun, and
well, that's great. And I saw it. It's, of course, it's brilliant. And it does, as I said, give you an opportunity to do so much of what you can do. It's funny, but it's also poignant. It's also incredibly touching. So you get to do the range, right?
Yeah.
Right, and then you get to do the voices. You get to do those other characters.
Mm-hmm.
It's so I imagine it was very seductive for you.
Very much so. Right? Yeah, I knew that I would enjoy it, and I had enjoyed my time last year here.
Mm-hmm.
It was very comfortable. I enjoyed the Sarasota audiences. I enjoyed where I was staying. I enjoyed Florida. You know, so I thought, yeah, that's great. You know, that'll be fun. And so I'm having a great time.
Yeah, it's great. I know that I was just dumbfounded by how many words there are.
Yeah.
And
it's very
God.
Specific. It's very specific because it's written by actually she's Irish.
Mm.
But it's very specifically worded in a way, so it makes it interesting.
And difficult, I would have thought.
It now that I know it, I do flub up a few times. I got myself in a little bit of something last night, and I got myself out of it. But because it really is, you know, when you're making a mistake. Let's put it that way. If it's not exact,
It doesn't always. I don't know how to say this exactly. the segues are not always so clear.
No, no, they're not always linear.
And right, exactly.
And they're not... It's almost, Michael describes it as like a stand-up routine, and it very much is
yes.
that,
yes.
as
it,
well
yes.
as a play.
Yes, and in the way that in a stand-up they'll go from this story to that story
right.
to this story, and as I said, the segues are not so clear. So if you get really in it, I can imagine you sort of saying, oh shit, what is next?
No, I actually was scared about that. I thought that would happen because it happened to me quite a few times in rehearsal. But now also what helps me is the sound cues. Our brilliant sound designer, Jane Shaw, was with us all through rehearsal. So she built the sound cues in the show according to what was going, how we were doing, how I was rehearsing. And there were a few times where I said, Jane, I think we need this here. And she was like, yeah, okay. So
can you give an example?
This doesn't help me find my way, but, that's not true. There's a birthday. I have like a birthday. I announce that, you know, this January 27th is a birthday of mine, and so she plays happy birthday music just before mm-hmm. I say
yeah.
the segue.
Mm-hmm.
So that, okay, it's my birthday. But to give you an example of Jane's collaboration, there's a segment in the show where she, I kind of don't want to give anything away, but you know, why not, where her mother dies. And her mother is a big rock fan.
Mm-hmm.
She's oddly enough a rock fan, and so she sends her off, the daughter at her funeral sends her off with Knocking on Heaven's Door, the Guns N' Roses version, at full volume. Those are the lines. And I said to Jane, I think we need to hear it because I'm pretty sure that 98% of this audience won't know what that is.
Yeah.
So she plays it, and
yeah.
it's great. It gives me a chance to get into the moment emotionally, and it gives the audience a chance to hear exactly what the song is. So that's what I mean.
And for those of us who know it, it's nice.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. It's, and so that's what I mean by the collaboration. Jane was exquisite that way. She was just right with me. And I'd say, you know, I don't think we need this. You know, after a while we'd have a sound cue and I'd say, you know, I don't really want to hear that now. And she'd go, okay, and she'd get rid of it. So it was a real collaboration. And it helps me to know where
you
I'm
know,
going.
Blocking. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Can cement language. You know,
sure.
you know if you're over here, then you're saying
yeah.
yes, and you're over there. But you don't have very much stuff over there to
Well, I do. I have the whole stage. I pretty much play down in not quite one, but more in two, you know,
mm-hmm. yeah.
the stage is divided in two. So I pretty much play in an area and go from right to left and occasionally use the depth of the stage. So I do know where I am during certain
and that,
sections. That helps.
Yeah, that does help.
Sure.
And I imagine that the sounds help in the same way. That
very much so.
Those things get attached.
Yes, very much so.
Right, yeah, right.
And there's great projections during the
oh,
show, so
yes.
those help immensely as well. So,
yeah, yeah.
No, the whole thing is a big collaboration between all of us.
Yeah, and it works so beautifully.
Yeah, I think it does. Well, I can't see it, but, you know.
Trust me.
Yeah, I'm sure it does. It feels like it does.
It does.
Yes.
It definitely does. And I want to say again and again that I've been saying, you know, it gives Mary an opportunity to do so much of what she is. But if you haven't seen Mary on stage, you really want to take this opportunity to come out and see her.
Yes, please come. Please
yeah.
come.
Because
yes.
it's a really brilliant performance.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Oh, no, it definitely is. So as long as I have you been doing anything that you want to talk about? Or
You mean in the theater?
Yeah, or not.
Well, I just finished doing. I was doing double duty because I rehearsed 2 weeks in New York this
mm-hmm.
this piece because I was doing Caucasian Chalk Circle at a theater company called Classic Stage Company. So I was doing Caucasian Chalk Circle at night and rehearsing this in
oh
the daytime.
Oh my goodness!
Yes,
you must have been dreaming words.
You know, it's what I did with this piece was what Michael and I. I think about 4 months ago, maybe in January, February, I said to him, I need to read this piece out loud. So he came to New York, and we sat and I read it out loud, and I taped it as I read it. And then there was a new script with some changes, so I had to ditch that. And what I did was, Michael said to me, I really think you should know it coming into rehearsal.
You should be called.
Yeah.
Right.
So I said, okay, but I was extraordinarily busy. I was booked solid until I came here. And so what I did was I would record it, I read it, 10 pages, a 40-page monologue. I recorded 10 pages at a time and would
listen
to it at night before I went to sleep. So when I got here, I knew the first act and about a quarter of the second act. And then that I learned the rest while I was here. But that was very helpful, the taping of it.
I'm sure it was.
Yeah, it was just me talking.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, well, I've employed that before. It's not as fun when you're doing a play with other people.
No.
Because you don't want to get set into, and that's the other thing, you don't want to get set into the way you hear it. Because you want to have the freedom to do whatever you want with it. So
well, and to respond to whatever somebody else is doing.
Right, exactly.
Right.
But
yeah.
But it was very helpful on the one woman thing.
Yeah, it's a great idea. Mm. All right, okay. So do you know what you're doing next?
I'm doing an opera next. There is a new opera called Anna Nicole, about Anna Nicole Smith. Whatever, that's her last name.
I think it is.
It's going to be at the Brooklyn Academy of Music in New York, and I start rehearsals for that in August. I don't have a very big part, but I've never done an opera before, and it's a stunning opera. It was in London a year ago, to great success, and so I'm very excited to do it because it's a real mix of people from musical theater and opera people, and it's a very, very progressive opera, so I'm really excited. And they're all jazzed about it. It's in collaboration with New York City Opera and Brooklyn Academy of Music.
Oh, bam. Wonderful.
So I'm excited to do that.
Yeah, wonderful. And you get to sing.
I get to sing. Yes, I don't have a lot to sing, but I do get to sing. Yes.
All right. Well, this was very sweet of you to come and talk to me about it. And do come out and see it. How long is it running?
It runs until July 14th.
All right, so you heard it here first. Well, probably not first, but you heard it here. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Because I didn't want to cut any more than I absolutely had to of these interviews, I have left myself with very little time in this show. Just enough time to remind you that if you want to get in touch with me, or you want to find out anything about me, or you want to listen to any of my past shows, or you want to listen to this show again, you can do all of that on my website, thelynshow.com. Remember to leave the E in Lynn. And as always, I hope that you got something you can use from this show, something that interested you or intrigued you, inspired you, or just made you laugh, something that will bring you back. Because I will be here next week, same time, same station. And as always, I hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you see my face and figure. I've both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight, no. I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated. Oh, fight, no, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, dang, no, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang.
may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flag, no, no. We will not go gentle into that good.